from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning, the population bomb, or is it that? And why is it that population remains an almost forbidden topic? We'll take up the question of how much of the world's population may or may not be on a population collision course with overall sustainability of the planet's resources. And we'll discuss who may be the most culpable between the third world or the developed nations of the world. Forum is next with your calls, emails, and online questions and comments after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum. From the dire concerns about population that emerged with the writing of Thomas Malthus at the end of the 18th century to the work of Paul Ehrlich in the late 60s and such prominent contemporary thinkers as Jeffrey Sachs and Neil Ferguson, there has been much hue and cry and what could be characterized as hand-wringing over population problems. Yet there are also those who go against the Cassandra-like views on population and say, as British environmental journalist Fred Pearce, that population is peaking and heading toward decline, and that the real problem for the planet's future is overconsumption. Are there enough resources to support the world's growing population, and just how much is the world's population actually growing? We take all of that up and more in this morning's opening forum hour with a panel of experts as we focus our attention on what is so often referred to as the population problem. Joining us from New Orleans is Julia Witte, who is author and journalist, an environmental correspondent for Mother Jones. Her next book will be out and be called Deep Blue Home, an Intimate Ecology of Our Wild Ocean. And we welcome you, Julia Witte. Good morning.
Good morning.
Glad also to have here in studio with us William Ryerson. Bill Ryerson is president of Population Media Center and also president of the Population Institute. Welcome.
Thank you.
And from New York City, Kavita Ramdas is joining us. She's president and CEO of the Global Fund for Women. They advocate for and defend women's human rights by making grants to support women's groups around the world. And welcome, Kavita Ramdas.
Thank you, Martin. Nice to hear you.
Glad to have you. Glad to have this panel assembled. And let me begin, Julia Witte, if I may, with you. And let's begin by talking about, well, we're going to try to make a link here between overconsumption, as it's so often called, or consumer consumption, and the world population. But certainly, as environmentalists see it, that is an ongoing concern. Why is it such a radioactive or taboo topic? Mother Jones took that up. Can you kind of spell it out to us?
Yeah, I think the problem with, we haven't spoken a lot about population, and I think it's been, there was a schism for a while between environmental and sort of human rights groups where the problem lay. And I think in the past, environmentalists may have been overly hard, and some of those points of view led to some, you know, less than desirable behavior. We had ways of dealing. We talked about population control, which is really not the way to handle it. We know that now in retrospect. But on the other hand, I would say that some of the human rights people maybe in the past weren't looking as clearly as we are now at the honest limits to growth on our planet. And I think actually that the viewpoints are now converging. We're realizing that it is a combination of numbers of people, but also, you know, it's not just the numbers of condoms, it's the numbers of credit cards. And I would say that we really are looking more and more at the number of credit cards. In other words, how much we're using and spending up that we don't actually have as capital.
I mentioned Fred Pearce in my introduction. He's been getting a lot of attention lately. He was on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. He wrote a book all about the population crash and myth, and he says population's peaking, as opposed to, say, somebody like Jonathan Porritt, who says we're on an exponential crash course with population. Which is it? Are we headed toward the slow, steady decline, or are we exponential?
Well, we are still growing, and most forecasts, you know, say we will grow until about 2050, and we're still growing at a fairly rapid rate. And it's not because the overall fertility numbers are very high. It's just that we have a very large population of people who are having fewer children, but there's still an awful lot of them having children. And so we are growing up until at least 2050, and we're looking out at a population of maybe 9.5 billion. We're currently at under 7 billion. So we're talking about adding about as many people as existed on the entire Earth in 1950. When we look at whether or not we have resources for all those people, regardless of what level they live at current consumption levels, we're already stressing our systems to the max. And so adding 2.5 billion more people is a real difficulty.
So it is the credit card and the condom both we're talking about.
It is both. Yeah. In my opinion, it's both. You know, we need to tackle all of it from both directions, obviously.
Now, let me bring Bill Ryerson into this discussion. And speaking about tackling it from both directions, curious thing about population as a topic, I spoke about it as being somewhat verboten, is both the left and the right don't like the topic.
That's true. The left is concerned that in a couple of cases, particularly China currently and India back in the 70s, human rights violations have occurred as a factor in trying to limit population growth. With, in the case of India, involuntary sterilization programs, in the case of China, their one-child policy with somewhat draconian enforcement. However, the vast majority of progress that's been made in promoting use of family planning and more broadly reproductive health has been done through voluntary approaches. So the left has associated the population issue with coercion, among other things. The right, to some extent, as epitomized by Julian Simon during the Reagan era, took and still takes the position the more consumers there are, the better the economy will be, so let us grow. And
they also don't like reproductive control or birth control of any kind often, do they?
Well, the right is really interested in economic growth as something that they see no limits to, and therefore having more consumers would be an unmitigated good. Clearly, there are limits to growth. We've known that for decades, but there are those on the right who don't recognize those limits or think that we're nowhere near those limits.
Oh, you're one of those who thinks that we're headed toward an ecological catastrophe in the next 50 years if we don't do something dramatic and drastic about overpopulation.
That's correct. And I'm, I think, backed up on that view by a lot of ecologists who have been looking at human impact on the global environment. For example, Peter Vitusek, a biologist at Stanford University, David Pimentel, a biologist at Cornell, both are now saying humans are appropriating about 50% of the global products of photosynthesis, i.e. all green plants. We can't use 100% even if we wipe out every other species on the planet. We're not that efficient. But we've already gotten to the point where we're having a huge impact on biodiversity by our consumption of just the products of photosynthesis. And it's really, in my view, impossible that we will have another doubling because the resources just aren't there.
Well, let's talk about your work because it's pretty extraordinary. Soap operas are the answer, at least to some extent. In Tanzania, we were talking about condoms before with Julia Whitty, 150% increase in condom use. I mean, that's quite an extraordinary feat in itself because of soap operas.
It is quite extraordinary. When I first heard the idea of using serialized melodramas as a way of addressing global sustainability issues, be it consumption or reproductive or other issues, public health issues, I thought it was a little bit crazy. But in fact, when you think about how each of us determines what behaviors to adopt, anything from clothing styles to how many children we might have or whether or not to educate our daughters, these are to a large extent dictated by social norms. And when people are in societies where for thousands of years it has been quite adaptive to have huge families because most of the children did not survive, now with public health measures, those children are, for the most part, surviving. But in many tradition-bound societies, people have not gotten to the point where the idea of having some personal say in how many children to have or spacing of children or limiting a family size may not have caught on. And so opening up the societal blinders through use of entertainment programs where characters role model alternatives and show the consequences, positive and negative, of various alternative behaviors has been a way of both.
This includes AIDS education, too.
Including AIDS education. This has been a way to help people see various options for their own lives and realize that they have more say over their reproductive decisions than they may have realized. And people, without ever being told what to do by these programs, but just observing the various characters and their behaviors, have had major changes in norms on the issues the programs have addressed.
And we're talking about something that sort of got underway in Mexico with Miguel Sabido. There was a good deal of success there.
Yes.
There's been success in India, and you've got programs now throughout Africa.
Yes, we have. We've done programs in 24 countries, including some in Asia and Latin America, as well as many in Africa. The most interesting statistic that we've just analyzed is out of our program in northern Nigeria, a conservative Muslim area in which many girls are sold into polygamous marriages at age 9 or 10. We have been doing a serial drama that role modeled allowing girls to go to school, allowing them to wait until adulthood to be married, allowing them to choose their own spouses, use of family planning, etc. And at the family planning clinic, 67% of the women coming in, when they're asked why they are there, cite our program as the reason.
And William Ryerson is president of the Population Media Center and also president of the Population Institute. And Kavita Ramdas is president and CEO of Global Fund for Women. There are about 200 million women who want no more children or want to delay the next pregnancy. And Kavita Ramdas, that, I suppose, statistic speaks for itself, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And I think I would agree with Bill. Our experience is similar with regard to women using different methodologies to be able to make their own choices and also be informed by options that they have available. We funded a program in Nicaragua, a similar sort of soap opera program, similar to the ones Bill has been talking about. And I think there's no question about the fact that if women are given greater choices, they do choose to have smaller families. But that needs to be connected with what Julia was saying earlier, which is economic growth. There also is a clear connection between women's empowerment and the choices they have available to them, not just because of limitations on tradition, but really because of real options with regard to economic choice and economic freedoms within their own country. So these two things are quite closely related.
Do you think that we're going to see family planning becoming more universal? It was supposed to be available to everybody by 2015 worldwide. At least that was the plan, wasn't it?
And the fact that the right also has very strong reservations against access to reproductive technology. But I think that is true not just of the right in the United States, but also of the right across the world.
We're going to get you on a landline because the connection is not too terrific here. Again, we're talking to Kavita Ramdas. She's in New York and on a cell. Bill Ryerson, you know, the blame, the culpability goes back and forth. Overconsumption, on the one hand, we hear from the developing world. And then on the other hand, we hear from, well, many in not only on the right, but certainly in the developed nations, that the problem is overpopulation in the third world or the developing world.
It depends which problem you're talking about. I mean, certainly, I was in Pakistan last week, and everybody I spoke with agreed that their population situation is a major driver of their poverty, of the shortage of water that that country is now facing. They have 20% of the water per capita that they had a half a century ago. They're facing very serious environmental and economic problems, and they're on a 30-year doubling time, going from 184 million today to as much as 368 million by 2040, if nothing changes. So that is clearly an issue for many country planners and leaders. On the other hand, environmental issues, topped, of course, by the climate change issue, are of concern in both developing and developed countries. But it is the developed countries with the very high per capita consumption rates that need to make the biggest changes in their behavior and to somehow get their economies off of the use of carbon. Nevertheless, The median projection that Julia was talking about, the UN makes of another 2.5 billion people, mostly in the developing world, between now and 2050, if that happens, is the climate equivalent of adding two United States to the planet. So it is not an inconsequential impact on the climate crisis.
Many of these poor countries are not making a carbon imprint, though, because they don't have the technology. And in fact, I'm wondering how many of them are really outfitted with televisions in the way that you would like them to be.
Well, many of them are outfitted with radio. For example, in Ethiopia, 4% of the population have television, but 60% have radio. So we're doing radio dramas. Think the 1930s in the U.S. But in many Asian countries, television is more widespread than radio. For example, in Pakistan, a very large majority of the population watches television on a regular basis. But in countries, particularly in Asia and China, of course, being the lead, the rates of consumption and greenhouse gas emissions per capita are going up as their economies expand. And so now China, in fact, is the leading producer of greenhouse gases in the world. It passed the United States within the last year.
But as long as we're talking about expansion of economies, Julia Witte, you hear from those who are more sanguine about the population problem and maybe see the world through the kind of glasses that Julia Simon, whom Bill Ryerson alluded to earlier, see things. You've got global agricultural output three times what it was in 1950. You've got a GDP that has increased eightfold. All the economies are expanding and rising per capita income through most of the world. That's the argument that's given for continuing this expansion, this globalization expansion.
Yeah, well, I happen to be down on the Gulf Coast right now reporting for Mother Jones on the oil spill. And I can tell you that the downside of that kind of expansion is what's going on here now, which is we're really seeing the death of the Gulf of Mexico. And that's what's happening. We're having to go to the farthest extremes to get the resources that we need now. The reason there's a spill currently in the Gulf of Mexico is because, you know, they're drilling 5,000 feet to this. They're going 5,000 feet to the seafloor and drilling thousands of feet below that. In agriculture, we actually have reached what some people are calling peak soil. We've run out of soil. We're losing topsoil now, and it's analogous to the fisheries issues offshore. Despite increased efforts, increased technology, we are just barely holding steady, and in some cases we're actually beginning to decline on agricultural production. This as our population continues to grow. I mean, we had the science journal Nature, I mean, the science journal Science recently did a whole issue on food security, and the conclusion was we don't actually know how to feed a growing population in a warming world. We're actually reaching the uppermost limits of our staple food crops to grow as temperatures increase. The photosynthesis itself begins to decline above 86 degrees Fahrenheit. We're actually reaching that in a huge swath of the developing world for certain, and even parts of the developed world. So we are seriously looking at the very real likelihood that these Malthusian predictions that people are so resistant to of truly mass starvation could be approaching in this century.
My goodness, you know, you mentioned Science Journal. Actually did an interview years ago for them with Garrett Hardin. You remember the lifeboat ethics guy who said, we've exceeded our carrying capacity, and he was talking doomsday all the time. Are you talking about Garrett Hardin type of lifeboat ethics here?
Oh, I definitely think we're looking, you know, again, I'm here in the Gulf, I'm looking at the results of having to drill inaccessible and just beyond our technological reach. And if you have any doubt, come down here and take a look at what's going on. You know, we're stretching beyond our limits, and we're no longer, I mean, also Paul Ehrlich has pointed out the idea that tell to the 300 million people every year who don't get enough food that there isn't, that there's plenty of food on the planet. And it's not just a matter of sending it here and there. It's more than that. We are actually running up against the limits of topsoil. So I don't know if people are familiar, but without topsoil, we still simply don't have the ability to grow crops. We're actually beginning to lose it now at a rate that threatens. There's nothing we can do. There's no genetic engineering. There's no way we can create topsoil. It's a process, a geological process that takes tens of thousands of years. And it's simply the way we're squandering topsoil and the way we're growing and the way we're forced to move out, just like drilling deep wells. We're drilling deep into places and working the very barely sustainable edges of it. And this is what we're seeing.
Julia Witte, again, is an author and journalist and environmental correspondent for Mother Jones Magazine. Kavita Ramdas is president and CEO of the Global Fund for Women. And Kavita, you know, there are some people who are giving a much more sanguine view of this, saying we've gone through a feminist revolution and reproductive changes have taken place to a wide degree. Healthcare is much better. Urbanization is changing things. All that bodes well, along with falling birth rates.
You know, I would unfortunately have to agree with Julia in the sense that I think even as we work hard to use new technology on, you know, this creating and growing more food, what we actually see, and women are sort of on the front lines of this struggle because they gather the world's food and gather most of the world's water. What they're saying to us in, you know, message after message that the Global Fund for Women gets is that it is getting harder and harder. They walk much longer hours every day for water and for firewood. So the challenges that we're facing really are at the level of uber consumption, if there's a word for that. I think that these two pieces that we're talking about, both the lack of freedom of women to be able to make reproductive choices in the ways that make sense for them within their own communities, and the fact that there simply is a level of consumption in the so-called developed world that is not sustainable and certainly not the model that we want countries like my own, India or China, to be galloping towards, which is exactly what is happening right now.
Yeah, I was reading some of your thoughts about how things are shifting in a strange way. The developing world sees the problem, as we've said, with overconsumption, but the developed world is their model, that is their economic model, and as a result you have this middle-class Indians who are trying to be like middle-class Americans and middle-class Americans who are eating organic food and being vegetarian.
Exactly. I mean, I think Tom Friedman calls this, you know, the little Americas all around the globe, and I think he's exactly right. I think the aspirations of the middle class, whether they're in Brazil or China or in, you know, in Zambia, are all the same. We all want to live and consume at the rates that we see Americans and to a lesser degree, Europeans living and consuming. That simply is not sustainable for any of us.
Well, if it's condoms and credit cards, as Julia Witte said, where women are concerned, for you it's three different C's. It's courage and contraception and choice for girls.
Absolutely, and I see that as being issues are, I think, in a place where there's more recognition about the need to empower women and to give them real choices. I think that's happening very late.
Yeah, let me go back to you on this, Julia Witte, because when you hear about successes like the kind that Bill Ryerson and his group are having, it seems to be certainly encouraging, but we need something much more dramatic in terms of environmental awareness here, don't we? Julia Witte?
Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah. No, I was posing a question to you. I was saying it's very encouraging when you hear about the kind of results that Bill Ryerson and his group are having.
Hello, I'm here.
Yeah, I'm sorry. But I said we need a great deal more consciousness where our environment is concerned. I think you've pretty much spelled that out here this morning.
Yeah, I think for sure. The more, I mean, we can certainly address the issues of a growing population all over the world. It's growing in many places, not only the developing world. And every effort that Bill Ryerson's group is making is good. But as Paul Ehrlich says, where's the condom for the morning after spree? Where's the morning after pill for the buying spree? We don't actually know how to address the problem of overconsumption. We don't have a condom for credit cards, and that's really what we need. And how do we address the fact that the developed world is also going to have to adjust, you know, the way we live in order to have enough for any of us to live on this planet in the coming
century. We're coming up on a break, and I want to give the phone number. I know there are many of you who would like to join us in this conversation about population. If you care, program, you can join us now. Our toll-free number is available to you. It's 866-733-6786. We welcome your calls. Again, toll-free, 866-733-6786, or send an email to forum@kqed.org, or you can join us by going on our website with questions or comments, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. There is a consensus that the Earth doesn't have enough resources to support the world's growing population, but there's disagreement about who's to blame. Some think the problem lies with the growing third world. Others that it is the consumption habits of the developed nations that cause the problem. We're sorting that out, and we have a panel with us that includes William Ryerson here in studio, who's president of the Population Media Center and also president of the Population Institute. Julia Witte with us from New Orleans is the author of a book that is forthcoming called Deep Blue Home, An Intermittent Ecology of Our Wild Ocean. She's an environmental correspondent for Mother Jones. And Kavita Ramdas is president and CEO of Global Fund for Women. They are advocates for and they defend women's human rights by making grants to support women's groups around the world. And she's with us this morning from New York. And we're going to go to your calls and emails here forthwith. Bill Ryerson had some comments he wanted to make, though, on consumption.
Yes, we know from looking at the U.S. behavior over the last 40 years that we have been unsuccessful in reducing per capita greenhouse gas emissions by even 1% in the last 40 years. Our population in the U.S. is growing by 1% a year, and our output of carbon pollution has been increasing in lockstep with our population growth. So, in fact, people's decision about family size in the U.S. has a bigger impact on the environment than any other country. Reducing one's family size by one child is a bigger contribution to solving the climate crisis than any of the technological changes one might make, like insulating the house or driving a hybrid car. And in fact, it has a 20 times greater impact than any of those technological fixes in the carbon legacy of the children that Americans produce.
Let's bring our callers into this, and we go first to you, Bill. Good morning.
Good morning, Michael. I'd like to bring up something that isn't often necessarily brought up here. It's not just the quantity of people that we can support on this planet. It's also the quality of life. And I'm concerned with land use and with the kind of world that we all inhabit and what happens when the world becomes overpopulated and we just don't have the quality of life that some of us would like to have. And that may sound a little self-centered, but and I agree that the threats to the sustainability of the planet are very real and probably the most important topic to be discussing, but I'm also concerned about what it's like to be here and how much open space we have and how much wilderness we have, and I think that's something that should be discussed as well.
Well, I thank you for bringing that up. Julie, what do you want to comment?
Yeah, I completely agree, Bill, with you on that, and I think it's a sad reality that we have these shifting baselines. We lose more and more of this very, very beautiful world we live on, and we don't remember from one generation to the next what we're missing. And I honestly think, personally, that the buffers of wilderness and solitude and quietness that we get in a good world enable us to actually make saner choices. And I fear that as we're driven away from those places we can go and reflect, you know, we kind of get caught up in this crazy cycle that enables us to just consume as if happiness comes from consumption.
Let me thank Bill for his call, and we'll go right to more of your calls. We'll go to Malcolm next. Good morning. You're on Forum.
Good morning. I'm Malcolm Potts, and I know Kavita and Bill, and congratulations on this program. As they know, I'm a doctor. I've worked around the world for 40 or 50 years in family planning. And I want to draw attention to the many unnecessary barriers which exist between women and the contraceptives they need. In Tanzania, you can't get the pill if you've had five children. In Madagascar, you can't get it if you've had no children. There's no scientific basis for this. And I want to suggest a bold step. In the United States, half our pregnancies are unintended. In California, we have a wonderful program called Family Pact, which averts 100,000 unintended pregnancies a year. Those pregnancies, if they were children that were born, would live for 70 years, have a huge carbon imprint. We prevent billions of dollars of costs of carbon by very good family planning. What we should do in the United States is to take the pill off prescription tomorrow. There are no scientific reasons for having it on prescription. A recent report out of England showed that women who take the pill actually live longer than women who don't. Let's make things available. Let's remove the unnecessary barriers in this country, in Nigeria, around the world, between women and the knowledge and technologies they need to separate frequent sex from childbearing.
Well, Malcolm, as you know, I'm an admirer of your work, and it's good to have you aboard here. There's a good deal of concern, though, even with something you're proposing that would result in religious conservative backlash in this country and elsewhere.
I don't think giving women freedom should ever cause a conservative backlash unless you are Neanderthal.
All right. Good to hear from you this morning, and I thank you for that. Let me go to a caller in Vallejo. Jed, you're on. Good morning.
Hi, Michael. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I really appreciated the comment from the previous caller. And to kind of piggyback on what you were saying, I come from a very large family that's Mormon. I'm not Mormon. But you can't talk to these people because they take it as an article of faith that there's a certain number of souls in heaven who have to come to earth. And it's their duty to God to have as many children as they can so that those children can be born Mormon, you know? You've also got devout Catholics who refuse to use birth control and a range of other religions out there who are just very much opposed to the idea that too many people could ever be a bad thing. How do you deal with that? And I like the social approach of soap operas and whatnot as a way to change norms so that it becomes normal to have a smaller family. And I'm very much opposed to government population control, but there's a certain segment of the population that just will not control themselves. And I don't know what to do about that. And I was hoping your guest could offer some insight.
Well, I've mentioned this twice now, Bill Ryerson, and I don't know. I mean, I know this is an uncomfortable area, but when we're talking about people's morality tied to religion and so forth, we're talking about a real issue.
I know that, indeed, when the Duggars had their 17th birth, and they now had 18 babies and, you know, are celebrating in the public their huge family, I sat down with a calculator and figured out what would happen if all of their offspring adopted a 17-child average family size for a moment in human history, just 10 generations. How many offspring would they have? And the answer is over a trillion. It was 169 times the current world population. It's clearly impossible that those large families can continue as an average without running out of resources and running out of people, in fact, that they could marry. Long before they got to the 10th generation, they would have married everybody on the planet. So it's not going to happen. And the question is, will we be able to educate people and motivate people to adopt smaller family norms, which is in everyone's interest to achieve global sustainability? And it's not clear that this will happen. But the key issue is, what's the average family size? And in the U.S., even though we have some outliers having 18 children, the average family size is around replacement level, and that's what is of importance in any country, is looking at the average.
I know that that is indeed the case, but I think the caller is still raising an important point here. And Kavita Ramdas, we'll try once more to see if we can get a decent connection to you. You're still in your car, I know, stuck in Manhattan traffic.
I know, sorry,
but I know you want to weigh in on this. There is concern that you have about this kind of backlash from religion and conservatives. Is there not?
I'm very concerned, but I think what's most important is actually connected to what we do in the developed world. It's very hard to give these mixed messages to the developing world. On the one hand, you're saying you want women to be able to have smaller families. On the other hand, as we just heard, you're preventing them from having access to the means they need to make those choices. And you're also exhibiting behavior in the United States that's inconsistent with your policies internationally. So this makes for messages that are simply very, very difficult to translate on the ground. And women's groups experience that when their governments turn around and say, well, the United States is against abortion and they don't provide contraception. And when the United States takes positions that are against access to contraception, as was the case for almost 8 years under the Bush administration, Women on the ground in many different parts of the developing world really experience that firsthand.
Well, look, I understand the concern about having the United States lead the way here, and one makes here's the same argument about nuclear disarmament and about really taking heed where respect to carbon footprint is concerned, that the United States has to take a leadership role. But that doesn't necessarily mean that other countries in the developing world are going to follow, nor does it mean...
Oh, no, absolutely. And in fact, I think that's the second part of my comment would be that's the reason to strengthen civil society on the ground, as the Global Fund for Women and many other groups are doing around the world, which is to strengthen the voice of women citizens in those countries. Because only women can demand changes, as they did right here in the United States. The pill became available because there was a women's movement putting pressure on this government.
Let me bring more of our callers in, and we go to Brian in San Francisco. Good morning.
Yes, I am a citizens activist with Results in the One campaign and a supporter of the Millennium Development Goals, which is a worldwide strategy for economic development for the world's poorest people, the 1 billion people on the bottom of the economic pyramid. And I know that as these people are able to increase their income and women have more choices, that they choose to have smaller families. My question is, there's a Millennium Development Goals evaluation summit coming up in September at the United Nations, where President Obama is committed to make a policy statement about the United States in relation to the Millennium Development Goals. Do the panelists have any suggestions on what President Obama should say at the Millennium Development Goals Summit at the UN coming up in September?
Now, Bill Ryerson, if you were writing his speech, what would you want him to say?
Well, clearly we've been talking about one aspect of the Millennium Development Goal. Goal number 5 has to do with maternal and reproductive health. And funding for family planning, which is a key part of the solution of what we've been discussing this morning, a population problem that is imperiling global sustainability. Funding for this has been cut since the Cairo Population Conference. So while Obama has started to restore and increase support for family planning assistance around the world since the years of the Bush administration, I think he should announce that we're going to give this much higher priority, along with much higher priority to addressing climate issues than we have to date.
And let me thank the caller. Go to some of your emails. Rick writes, I think it's important to point out that religion is what is pushing population up and keeping measures from limiting it from being effective. And again, we're hearing this from listeners. Here's Lee, who says, overpopulation denial is exemplified by the illegal immigration debate. You can watch dozens of programs on the topic without one word being said about Mexican overpopulation by either right or left wing pundits. Yet Mexico's population has increased eightfold in the last century, from 13.1 million in 1900 to 111 million today, way more than Mexico's economy can support. Meanwhile, the American debate totally ignores the elephant in the living room, along with the Catholic Church's role in this, even though the left doesn't hesitate to attack the church on other topics. It's bizarre. Another listener writes, I know no one likes to talk about forced population control. China's one-child policy has been widely criticized. My back-of-the-envelope calculation shows that a reduction of the birth rate down to 1.7 or 1.8 could greatly reduce the population within 200 or 300 years. Can any of the guests comment on what it would take to reduce the population in half in 200 or 300 years? Bill Ryerson.
Well, let me comment on both the Mexico and the China comments. Mexico, of course, does have a rapid growth in its population, and it is the push factor in countries like Mexico and elsewhere around the world that are causing people to emigrate. In reality, moving people from their home country to another country where they may not speak the language as a solution to poverty problems is not the ideal. The ideal is to put much more effort into both family planning assistance and economic development in countries like Mexico so that people are able to stay home and lead economically productive lives. China's policy, and I've spent a lot of time in China, has been based on their fear of mass starvation. And indeed, China had 30 million people starve to death during the Cultural Revolution, so they know what this is all about. They're losing underground aquifers to irrigation at a rapid clip. The Yellow River does not reach the ocean two-thirds of the year. And China is now buying land in Africa and Eastern Europe in order to feed the growing Chinese population. So, indeed, there are understandable reasons for their alarm. On the other hand, all of China's neighbors have achieved lower birth rates than China voluntarily. And so I don't believe China's success is based on the coercion. I think it really is the fact that they mobilized several million people to go door to door to talk to their neighbors about the issue of family size and China's welfare. And I think they could have done a better job had they just done this on a voluntary basis rather than using the heavy hand of coercion.
Let me go back, if I may, to Julia Whitty, because and mention the name Fred Pierce again. He's saying that the population is going to stabilize by 2040. He's very sanguine about that. And he also says we're an older society, and therefore we're wiser about all these issues, and that all bodes well also.
Well, before we go there, I'd like to backtrack for 1 second.
Sure.
Because I have a question for Bill, and going back to that last email that you read, and also Jed, and that, you know, we still haven't really talked about this religion issue too much and how it plays out in our own world. And, you know, my question to Bill is, well, can we or why don't we have soap operas sort of reaching out to Mormons and Catholics and the Duggars as a way to try and get that change going on among the resistant people in this country who think there isn't a problem with 18 children in a family?
Julia, I'm spending most of this week in Los Angeles. We're doing a training workshop for Hollywood writers in preparation for a program using our strategy for the first time in the United States. However, as I'm sure you know, doing a program for the U.S. public is not easy for a small nonprofit organization. Getting on the airwaves is difficult, and the audience here is fragmented among 500 television channels and however many radio stations there are. So it's a difficult area to work in, but I agree with you, it's vitally important.
Going back, Julia, to the numbers again, if you could, what about somebody as optimistic about things as Fred Pierce, who says we've got stabilization by 2040 of our population?
Yeah, but what number are we stabilizing at? We've already talked about that. We're stabilizing at a number that's unsustainable at the current lifestyle. You know, what are we going to stabilize at? Disaster? That doesn't sound like a very good scenario to me. So we have to look at ways that before we reach that stabilization, we're already mitigating the problems that we're adding another 2.5 billion people. How are we going to do that? How are we going to live more sustainably? Maybe we will begin to slowly taper off after that, and I think we will. But in the meantime, we have to sustain an awful lot of people on an ever-shrinking amount of resources.
Well, Bill Ryerson wants in here, but I have to read one more email. This is from Daniel, who says, the elephant in the room is the Malthusian predictions in the past have all turned out to be incorrect. he's right about that, I believe. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Bill.
Well, on the issue of automatically stabilizing by 2040 or 2050, I think it is a prediction that is fraught with a lot of risk. That is to say, the UN Population Division makes three scenario projections, not predictions. And the one they term their median projection, an additional 2.5 billion people, is based on the assumption that fertility rates, the number of children born to a woman during her lifetime, in every country of the world will fall to 1.85 by 2050. So, you know, the reality is that in some countries, people want far bigger families than that. And so there's nothing automatic at all that makes this just going to happen. And in fact, the high projection, which is over 10 billion by 2050, could come to pass if we let up on family planning assistance around the world. So I think making statements that, it's automatically going to happen, so don't worry about it, is naive. I think we really need to keep pushing. Now is not the time to back away from this issue.
Kavita Ramdas, let's hope that we've got a good line here and get you back into this. Are you with us? Kavita Ramdas?
Hi, I'm here.
Yeah, I'm certain you want to put a word in here, don't you?
Well, I think I just simply want to say that I think there are real issues that we need to be looking at with regard to changing cultural assumptions here in the United States. And my issue was not that I thought the United States
could lead simply by demanding a change in other governments. But I think the U.S. does act as a center for a lot of export of cultural assumptions around the world. And I think if we had some different assumptions that could be shared around access to reproductive rights, around the use of birth control, I think those would be good messages to share.
Okay, let me go to more of our callers, and we want to bring Hugh on from Oakland. Hugh, hi.
Yes, hi. I wanted to know what your guest thoughts were on what they are saying a reduction in consumption means for the capitalist model, especially for public companies and the stock market, which relies on expanding consumption for growth in investment.
Hugh, it's a good question. I want to dovetail it with an email here from Paul, who says the rising GDP and income statistics that were cited by you, Michael, are a symptom of not real global wealth, but of exploding global debt. Always remember, debt used for consumption pulls future demand into the present, but the resulting wealth is entirely fictitious if future production cannot service the debt. And we are there. In addition to peak population, oil, water, and soil, we are at or approaching peak debt, which is why the right wants more population growth. More debts, slaves are required to keep the Ponzi debt bubble from collapsing. Julia Whitty?
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, in this current article in Mother Jones, that we have a sister article called Nothing Grows Forever, Why Do We Keep Pretending the Economy Will, by Clive Thompson, addressing exactly this issue and some interesting models of ways that we can live more sustainably, how we can create a sustainable economy, not an ever-growing economy. And it's the only way we're going to successfully transition through this limits of growth that we've come up against now into a sustainable future that will actually keep us all in a state of well-being on this planet, or otherwise, in the words of Stephen Hawking, we're going to go off looking for some other planet to raid.
And let me go to more of our callers. And we go to Little Rock, Arkansas. Thomas, join us. Hi.
Yes, your guest that was talking about topsoil erosion. Is this a North America problem? I work in agriculture, and I see the U.S. farmer very concerned with soil conservation and sustainable tillage. Is this developing nations dust bowl?
Julia Whitty.
Yeah, it's actually all over the world.
It's global. Yeah.
Yeah, it is a global issue, and we're farming margins. We're coming up against not only the loss of topsoil from bad agriculture, but we're having increasing desertification as the globe warms. So marginal lands are becoming even more difficult to farm, where they're becoming even more susceptible to topsoil loss, erosion, and so on. And so the problem is coming at, as with so many of these problems, it's coming from many directions at once, and it's exacerbating it from a lot of different directions.
And we thank you, Thomas, for the question. Here's a question from a listener named John, who says, shouldn't the USA be trying to do something about its own population growth, given that we're supposedly using 25% of the world's resources? And you say what, Bill Ryerson?
Absolutely. We need to adopt a population policy in this country and work towards stopping population growth. The majority of citizens of the U.S. in poll after poll since the 1940s have favored stopping growth in this country. Two presidential commissions have called for stopping growth in this country. So that is something that is an urgent priority from most people's standpoint. However, there are business interests that are looking for continued growth. I think particularly the construction industry wants to see growth continue, whether it's sustainable or not, because they're getting housing starts out of it. But it's not a reason to have the kind of headlong rush towards an overcrowded America that we currently have.
And Luce makes a good point. A listener from El Cerrito says it used to be that only a couple of generations were alive at the same time. Now it's possible to have four generations occupying the planet at the same time. Even if people only had enough children to replace themselves on the planet, the fact that we're living so much longer seems to be an important factor. And as I said, of course, Fred Pierce, who seems to think more optimistically than most of the things we've been hearing here this morning, says that's a good thing. People are older and wiser, as Coleridge said about the Ancient Mariner. Let me get another caller in, and that's Mo. Good morning.
Yeah, hi. How do we teach these third world countries to be like America, and then at the same time, if they become like America, there's not enough to go around. There's only so much pie. It's like the last question said, 25% of consumption occurs in the United States.
Yeah, Kavita Ramdas.
Hi, I'm finally on a landline.
Thank heavens.
Thank
yes.
you. I know, really. So much for technology, right? I think this is exactly the point that I think we're all grappling with, that on the one hand, the only model of development that is currently being proposed for all the world is to sort of follow the capitalism model that the West has essentially proposed for the rest of the world. And the problem, as we have all talked about endlessly on this program and in other places, is that if we do that, we're actually headed for the disasters, not just of the kind of the Gulf Coast, but of many other different kinds of disasters with regard to consumption. I do think that we need to be having a conversation not just about women's empowerment, but also about a changed model for economic and political growth that we can think about. And that's sort of a conversation that's really not on the table, because somehow, even with this financial crisis that we've just had, there is a reluctance to talk about the fact that modern capitalism in its current rapacious form is actually not a sustainable model for most of us on the planet, and that we need to find some way to balance, as Mahatma Gandhi would say, there's enough on this planet for everyone's need, but not for everyone's greed.
Kavita, here's a listener who compares India and China. I'm curious to get your take and response, and writes, India tried voluntary family planning at around the same time as China made it mandatory. The 300 million differential in the results should speak for themselves. The fact of everyone's philosophical opposition to coercion is irrelevant to its necessity.
Well, I don't believe that coercion, I mean, I would be with Bill on this. I don't think that coercion by a government or anybody else actually results in the outcomes you really want to see. Invariably, it causes a backlash. And I think that you are seeing that in China. There's huge increases in trafficking of young women into China, where the imbalance between male and female birth rates has been profound due to the one-child policy. And I think the same thing is happening in India, actually, in the most prosperous parts of India. Ultrasound technology is being used to selectively abort female fetuses. So it's not a straight shot transformation in terms of culture and psychology. And I don't think that coercion is enough to be able to sort of get the outcomes. What you do need is a combination of a process by which you change cultural assumptions within a society, and you have strong government action to be able to make the resources available. And I think Bill spoke to this quite clearly when he talked about the fact that, you know, if contraception is made easily available and accessible to women around the world. And I think it's important to say to women, because condoms are actually not that helpful, because you need male participation to be able to use condoms effectively.
That's going
to
be a whole other topic, but we've come to the end of this hour, and it's been a most illuminating hour. In fact, I'm getting a lot of emails with a lot of gratitude for the fact just that we're doing this hour. So I want to extend thanks to our panel, to you, Kavita Ramdas, President and CEO of Global Fund for Women, to Julia Witte, who is environmental correspondent for Mother Jones. Her next book will be Deep Blue Home, and to Bill Ryerson, President of Population Media Center and President of Population Institute. Thank you, one and all. Thanks to you, our listeners. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation, and the Bernard Osher Foundation, supporting higher education and the arts.